Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Department for Children and Families has a difficult but important task. It's supposed to support families and protect Vermont's children. A lot of what it does involves reacting to outside forces that can have a negative impact on family life, things like drug abuse, poverty, homelessness, and trauma. Sometimes those things lead to parents who themselves are not healthy for their children to be around, but sometimes the situation is bad, but the parents are not, and a lot of times it's somewhere in between. So what's the right approach to when it's appropriate to separate children from their parents, and what should our approach to reunification be? And how can DCF help address the underlying problems that lead to family instability and abuse or neglect? Those questions provide the framework for the conversation we're going to have today on the show, as we are joined by Ken Schatz, Commissioner of the Department for Children and Families. But we'll also be looking at concrete issues like what should happen to the state's only juvenile detention facility, Woodside, which has faced problems with federal regulators and is no longer getting federal funds. Commissioner Schatz, thanks for joining us today. It's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what is the overarching philosophy here about how DCF helps to support families?
I really appreciated your introduction because I think you said it very well. We certainly do want to protect children and support families. And we do that in a variety of ways. We work very hard to have an array of services and programs working with community partners to make sure we're looking at these both from a community perspective and also on an individual case-by-case basis.
So when it comes to actually removing children from their parents, either their biological parents or the parents that they are living with, what goes into a decision like that? And we'll get into some of the other stuff that DCF does, because it's not all about the foster care system and separating or reunifying families. But what goes into a decision of when a child might be removed from a family situation?
So I appreciate the opportunity to talk about other things, too. But these decisions are what we think of as high risk, high consequence decision making, and our family service workers have had increasingly sophisticated approach at trying to look at how to appropriately assess risk and danger. So we want to carefully look at the situation. We use some objective tools, and we also try to make a careful decision based on the circumstances in each individual case. I also think it's really important to recognize that DCF does not act alone here. So our family services workers, upon receiving a report of child abuse or neglect, will certainly carefully look at the situation. They may make a recommendation that the child should be removed from the family in extraordinary cases, to be sure. Our initial thought is to try to do the best we can to enable children to stay with their families. But if there is the event we request removal, there actually are several steps. We don't make that decision alone. We would bring that recommendation to the state's attorney. The state's attorney would review it, and if the state's attorney thinks it makes sense, the state's attorney will present that to a judge. The judge will be the ultimate decision maker. There's also an attorney for the parent and the child and a guardian ad litem who all have an opportunity to review the situation, circumstances, and weigh in on what's the appropriate course of action.
How many children on average are removed per year?
Well, I'd have to step back and look at that more carefully, but what I would tell you right now, there's approximately 1,350 children in DCF custody.
Right now.
Correct. There's also other categories that's worth noting, that there's about 800 children who are in the category called conditional custody, where they're involved in the court system and their custody remains either with their biological parent or a relative, but DCF is asked to provide some supervision.
So I think you said about 1,300, 1,350
Correct.
Right now in that system. And is it still the goal of the department to place a child who's removed from his or her parents with other family members, biological family members? Because for a while that has been the first priority.
So we don't – I don't want to say that it is the first priority. We'll really look at that on a case-by-case basis because there are all sorts of variables that come into play. But we do definitely look at extended family as a place that we'll look really carefully at, and if it makes sense, if we do need to place the child outside the biological parents, if we can place it with the extended family, we do so in approximately 40% of those cases.
And depending on who you talk with, the system for reunification can either be too onerous, that it's way too hard for parents to be able to regain custody of their children, or that it's too lax, too lenient, that parents who shouldn't get their children back are, and that foster parents who would like to adopt, who are doing foster to adopt, or who are, you know, rightly protective of the children in their care, say it's too easy for the parents to get their children back. How do you walk that very fine line?
So I really appreciate that question, and let me start out by expressing my admiration and respect for both our family service workers, foster parents, and prospective and adoptive parents in our community, because they are really giving their love, their commitment to try to take care of these children. And as you correctly point out, there are fine lines here. And they certainly it's case by case. And honestly, as the commissioner for Department for Children and Families, I know I'm not winning any popularity contests. Because the reality is, again, our family service workers make these high consequence, high risk decisions. And so we have to make it's recommendations to other players that can involve the court to be sure. So there are safeguards. But the reality is we have to do an individual assessment. One of the things that we have done as a frankly, as part of our improvement after those horrific child fatalities, is we recognized in cases of really serious abuse, we needed to expand our the information and the players in helping to make decisions. So we have made an active effort to have a system where we engage in consultation and a team approach, both in terms of investigating allegations of serious abuse and, when appropriate, considering reunification. So we don't want to take anything off the table, but we do want to carefully consider the alternatives.
We're talking with Ken Schatz. He's commissioner of the Department for Children and Families, and we're talking about several different issues surrounding DCF today, including what should happen to Woodside Juvenile Detention Facility, which has lost federal funding, but also just looking at DCF in general, how these decisions are made. It's been a while since we've had a show where we just sort of open the door to what's happening with DCF and also the underlying situations that are putting pressure on families and really causing families to struggle. Things like the opioid crisis, homelessness, trauma and abuse in families' past, which can be carried on to new generations. Commissioner Schatz can't talk about individual cases in answering any questions, but it is important to remember in every single one of these cases, we're talking about real families, real kids, real people who are trying to struggle and survive and figure out what's right for these kids. And I don't want that to get lost in this conversation. We're talking about regulations, but of course, every situation is different and every situation involves real people. And that's important to keep in mind.
Absolutely. And I really do appreciate that. We definitely are mindful of the fact that parents love their children. And so that even when bad things happen, we are really aware that we, need to do the best we can to address each situation. If I could, I will. You mentioned the particular stresses and you've mentioned the opioid issue. And so I want to be very clear that the challenges our community faces with respect to the opioid epidemic has really made a challenging difference in our child welfare system, because it is many young parents who find themselves, when they are addicted, to not being able to safely care for their children. And so our caseload has increased substantially in the last few years, primarily as a result of the opioid addiction that's afflicting our community. And that has been a tremendous challenge for us to try to address. It has resulted in a significant increase in very young children coming into our custody, which has also been some changes for us to address. And we're doing the best we can.
Why younger children? I mean, younger families?
It seems to be young parents who, because of the opioid epidemic, are particularly impacted. And so
and their children are younger.
With young children, correct.
we've talked about this in the past, and you know, it seems like when we talk with the health department, they're working on getting a handle on overdose deaths and trying to reduce that. But in terms of what you're seeing with parents and families where there is active addiction and it's making it more difficult or impossible for children to be safe, you're not seeing any stemming of the tide in that?
So we have not. The caseload increase has continued. The numbers of new case filings has remained high in the court system. So we do believe that medication-assisted treatment, of course, is a really important step forward that the state has made and really appreciate that. What we also recognize, though, is that particularly for people who are even in recovery, parenting issues can still be really challenging. And so again, maybe for me, that's a segue to talk about what we're doing about this. And the legislature did actually recognize the challenges that our child welfare system is under, particularly related to the opioid epidemic. And so the legislature did have an initiative to create a work group to look at strategic reform of our children in need of care and supervision system. The members of that work group include the judiciary, the Defender General's Office, the State's Attorney's Office, and my office. We have actually worked very hard on thinking about really how could we make significant reform. And we have just presented our draft, our preliminary report, to a legislative committee. But the point that is relevant to this is I think all of us agreed that we just can't fix the court system to deal with these caseloads. We need to go back further. We need to address the needs of very young children and their parents. And so the key part of our proposal is to do a pilot approach to address pediatric social workers and home visiting with an approach to really address the needs of young children who involved with parents with addiction, and also to support the parents as needed to get into recovery to safely parent their children.
So how much of that is on DCF? I mean, part of the question here is DCF is part of this whole situation and part of all of what's happening in Vermont and in our culture and with support. So, you know, if the role of DCF is, for example, to come in when there's a problem, how does DCF roll that back? You're talking about some of it, but how do you roll that back and work with the other agencies and departments to intervene before there's a problem? Because once it gets to you, there's a problem, you know? And so how do you then, with limited funds, say, look, this is what you guys need to be doing to help us so that, you know, we're not jumping in here after something has happened?
So this pilot idea is part of that, to work collaboratively with the health department potentially, and actually within DCF, we also have the Child Development Division. Our Child Development Division has a program called Children's Integrated Services, where we do try to work with very young children with special needs. And again, that's part of the population that we know that if we can work successfully with the parents to make sure the children are being well taken care of, that can hopefully help reduce the need for entry of our child welfare system.
For parents who are in active addiction or who are looking for treatment, trying to say, you know, I need some help. Is there a fear that admitting that you have an addiction will get your children taken away from you?
I do appreciate that concern, and we've actually worked very hard with a variety of substance abuse providers and healthcare providers to make people clear and understand that we don't assume that if someone has an addiction problem that the children are unsafe. Those are actually two separate questions. So that going into treatment and recovery, it makes perfect sense, of course, and in what we have to make sure is that the needs of the child are being taken care of. So that's the approach we take.
And does that happen in practice? I mean, that's a good philosophy, but does in practice, if somebody says, I have an addiction, I am seeking treatment, you know, does in practice that sort of trigger something that then leads to more questions about the safety of a child's environment and often lead to removal?
So I don't think it often leads to removal. I do think our healthcare community and our substance abuse community are actually quite good at parsing through those distinctions. And so they're certainly going to be mindful of the issues. But my understanding is actually we do a very good job of only taking children into state custody if it's really absolutely necessary for the protection of the safety of the child.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with DCF Commissioner Ken Schatz about how the Department for Children and Families is being impacted by the opioid crisis, as well as its approach to family reunification in the foster care system. Elizabeth is on the line from Jericho. Hi, Elizabeth. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Commissioner. My comment, I'm a guardian ad litem, and my comment is that I know that everybody at DCF is doing their best. The attorneys are doing their best. What we really, really need, and I hope I can impress everybody who's listening to this, what we need are good foster homes for the children, because the process can take years, and we need a safe and loving place for the kids to stay while the court figures out what is the best choice, best decision to make for these children. So please, this is a plea for people to consider being foster parents for these children who need a safe and loving place. Thank
Elizabeth, yeah, thanks for your call. And just for people who aren't aware of the program that Elizabeth is part of, Guardians Ad Litem are representatives of the children. So they serve as somebody whose primary goal through the court process is to advocate for the child in question, not for the whole family. They don't act as a lawyer exactly, but their job is to be that child's advocate. And Elizabeth mentioned that she's a guardian ad litem. But Elizabeth, making the plea here for more foster families, is that something that we have a shortage of here?
Absolutely. So I want to thank Elizabeth for her work, but also making a very appropriate and timely pitch to enable members of the community to know we really do need more foster parents. With the increasing caseload, the need continues. And so we really do appreciate anyone who's interested getting in touch with our office, and we're glad to share information about
what happens to a child if there isn't a foster family available.
You know, we've always managed to work it out. I mean, I think that I never want to get to a place where we can't figure out what to do with a child. And again, it's back to our staff, who are incredibly creative when they need to be, to make sure we take care of every child that's put under our care.
There are no institutional settings where children go and live not with a family, but live in a facility?
Well, we have some residential treatment programs. So that is a thoughtful decision about if a child needs to be in residential care. That's not because of a lack of foster homes.
Got it. So no child is going to a residential system because of a lack of foster homes, but it is because of other issues that the child might need some help in addressing.
That's correct.
So I want to talk about Woodside Juvenile Detention Facility. I mentioned this. This is the only facility that is for children who are going through the court process for criminal activity. It's in Colchester. It's just down the street from the VPR headquarters here in Colchester. I've been through it. It has struggled for a couple of years now with federal funding and federal regulation, and the federal government recently said, we're not going to be funding it anymore. It doesn't meet our requirements for being a rehabilitational facility. And there seems to be some question about whether, you know, it should be sort of seen as a correctional facility. It is under the Department for Children and Families, not under the Corrections Department. But what's going to happen to Woodside?
So if I can back up a little bit to clarify, so it's youth who are engaged in delinquent behavior, and they are addressed through our family court system. And what we were certainly disappointed in the decision by the federal government in late 2016 to end funding. We had actually the legislature and the administration back in 2011 decided to not have Woodside be simply a detention facility, but in fact create a treatment program. The staffing was changed. A more clinical approach was undertaken. We did receive Medicaid funding for years. My understanding of the federal decision is it wasn't based on the fact that we weren't a rehabilitative facility, but rather the population were all youth who were involved in the justice system. And that is not something that the federal government is used to funding under Medicaid. And so we did try to work with them a long time to try to convince them that actually under our Vermont system, it did make sense to recognize that, in fact, we were a rehabilitative facility and that we should receive Medicaid funding. But at the end of the day, a few months ago, I decided that it just was not going to be successful, that the federal government couldn't get past the fact that all of these youth were involved with the justice system. And so what going to your question in terms of what's going to happen, that's actually a work in progress. We took this as an opportunity to reflect, to say, okay, we've done some good things at Woodside. We've actually reduced the number of youth there, which from my perspective is healthy. We want to only use a locked facility like that as a last resort. But we still have some work to do in terms of even the treatment approach that we want to apply. We have some challenges and problems, and I'm committed to working on that to make Woodside the best facility we can be to care for our kids. But the question in terms of the future includes, do we need a secure facility? And if so, who should it serve and what size should it be? And
you've said you don't want to close Woodside, but you're open to changing what Woodside is?
That is absolutely right. But I did explore that first question. I did talk with our staff, with our other partners within the Agency of Human Services, and other community providers and stakeholders. And basically, pretty much everybody agreed we in Vermont, for a relatively small number of youth, do need a secure facility. So I've said quite publicly that I do believe we continue to need Woodside. But as you indicated, I'm very open and considering and thinking about the size, the population, and the type of program to provide. So that's something we're looking forward to presenting to the legislature in the coming session.
Can I push you with a question from Robert, who says, how does the commissioner justify the $3 million per year price tag of Woodside, given that the average daily population is about 10 and there are viable alternatives? Additionally, the facility's record of licensing challenges and legally questionable restraints on juveniles makes me wonder, why should we continue to support Woodside?
So I think that the reason to support Woodside is because we do have – it's a small population, as I've indicated. The question
– And is Robert right? It's about 10
no,
per day?
No, it's higher than that. I don't have that off – The population ranges between 10 and 15, 16. So,
and it's something like 90 individuals who go in over the course of a year.
I think it's about 130 individuals over the course of the year. I'll have to check that to be sure. But the point is that's not a totally small number. We do have sometimes the need in the middle of the night when a youth comes to the attention of the law enforcement or the judiciary that they need a safe, secure place to be. And for some period of time until we can figure out what makes the most sense, we need a secure facility. Similarly, for a relatively small number of youth, we do need to provide a longer-term treatment approach. One of the things I'm looking at, for example, though, in terms of this question, is we do have a significant number of youth who are actually out of state. And so one of the questions is there a way to redesign the treatment program at Woodside so that maybe we can bring back some of those youth who are currently out of state?
And so, when we talked about that before, that's because there are specific programs, medical programs or rehabilitational programs that aren't available at Woodside, partly because it is such a small population. You can't support caseworkers or psychiatrists, psychologists who work in this specific area if you don't have people who need it frequently.
That's right. And so one of the opportunities I'm going to make a pitch for a new facility, because part of the challenge we have at Woodside is it was built as a juvenile jail. It looks like a juvenile jail. And so for the last 3 years, I've been working with the legislature to try to create plans and funding to really create a facility that is a residential treatment program consistent with our goals and values and the needs of our youth.
So while still being locked.
Yes. So in fact, it would still be locked, although my vision is that it actually would have some flexibility so that there would be pods, some locked and unlocked, so that we can allow for transitions and maybe a better variety of uses to meet the needs of children who really do need a highly supervised setting.
So we'll talk more about this as you look to revamp Woodside, because there are certainly still questions to come on that. I know that DCF is involved right now in revamping the rules around Vermont's emergency housing program for people who don't have homes, and especially right now, as the weather turns colder, sometimes on the coldest nights, people, individuals, families can get into hotel rooms, and I know that that's an onerous program and process. How much of a problem is homelessness for families right now?
It is a very significant problem in our state. And it's interesting, when I heard the promos for my presentation here, you talked about Commissioner Schatz has been here for 4 years, and I actually took that to heart. It's an opportunity for reflection. And frankly, the issue of homelessness was a very significant problem when I started, and I have to acknowledge that it continues to be a significant problem. I think we've done some good things, though. We've created an expanded shelter system working with community partners throughout the state so that we have some better ability to provide stable, warm, safe places for homeless individuals and families, and also to do a little bit better at enabling them to move on to better settings that are stable living situations, as opposed to simply being in motels. And I think we had made some progress in terms of reducing the numbers of motel stays. Unfortunately, what I have to tell you now is that the problem seems to be getting worse. And I honestly—
Just recently?
Yes. In the last few months, we have reviewed our data. We're approximately 30% over where we were last year in the number of families and bed nights served in our emergency housing program.
Why do you think?
It's a source of great concern for me. I don't have a simple answer. I think poverty is such a challenging issue everywhere. This is a trend, by the way, that we've seen throughout the country. It's not as if we're alone in this. But I do think that we do have an economy where we have very low unemployment. So people are getting jobs. So a little piece of good news is our caseloads in reach-up and three squares is down. So that's a healthy thing, people getting jobs. But I think that there is a segment of our population face significant barriers to enabling them to get jobs, to be successful. And some people get jobs, to be fair, too, but they're low-paying jobs. So they really can't afford the housing that's out there. So in many ways, we really have an affordable housing problem for a population of people with very low incomes. And that's an ongoing challenge for us. Again, I think we've done some good work through the Vermont Housing Conservation Board, the governor's initiative in terms of a housing bond. But my point to you is we have more work to do. Homelessness is a very serious problem in communities throughout the state.
And of course, again, an issue that is not just DCF's to solve. So you have to work on this sort of as a broad coalition and across many, many platforms. Do you work well with the other departments and agencies around the state, do you think?
I believe we do. I think it's one of those hallmarks of the values of Vermont, that actually all of us are actually very willing to sit down together, talk through these issues and work on them. And so your point is well taken, that clearly the housing issue is one where there are numerous partners. And in fact, yes, we engage, I think, quite well with a variety of other agencies, community providers all around the state, and are doing our best to talk about and figure out a way to solve that problem.
That's Ken Schatz, Commissioner of the Vermont Department for Children and Families. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
More to come on this issue as the months proceed, including what's going to happen with the legislature reforming the CHINS process. That's the Children in Need of Care and Supervision, $7 million set aside. The first report from the working group that included several different constituents, including DCF, has come out recently. And we'll be looking in the future at what happens in the short term and in the long term on that.